Hello, and welcome to the latest RevDem Rule of Law podcast. My name is Oliver Garner. Our guest today is Jenny Orlandosson. Jenny is a PhD researcher at the University of Copenhagen, and previously she worked at the Permanent Representation of Malta to the EU, and as Deputy Head of Mission and Consul to the Embassy of Malta in Egypt and Sudan. Today we'll be discussing the rule of law situation within Jenny's home member state of Malta. So Jenny, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Oliver, and thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be able to discuss Malta, and a real treat to finally meet you, at least via Zoom. I've been following your work for so long that it feels like a bit of a homecoming, finally meeting you in person, well, through Zoom.
Thank you so much, and it will be of great interest to our listeners as well. So Europe and the world were shocked by the murder of the Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia in 2017. How would you assess the current situation in Malta in terms of rule of law, democracy, corruption, and freedom of the press?
I think first and foremost, before I deep dive into that question, Oliver, I really would like to give just a little bit of context about what I'm talking about, because the rest of the conversation we're having probably won't make any sense to listeners who haven't previously encountered Malta or read anything about Malta, or you know, had even Malta, you know, anywhere near their or on their radar. So Malta was a former British colony up until 1964. It is now an active member of the Commonwealth. Its religion plays a major role in the country. So the Catholic religion is enshrined as the state religion in the constitution. It is taught in schools. And the continued hold and power of the Catholic Church has meant major restrictions in terms of social progress. For instance, Malta only introduced divorce into its civil code in 2011, so very, very recently. And it is the most restrictive EU member state and one of the most restrictive in the world in terms of abortion laws, with near blanket criminalization and still very, very tough, extreme criteria to procure an abortion in the country. So it's deemed extremely conservative. It's a tiny country, and when I mean tiny, I mean 316 square kilometers. It's the 10th smallest country by area and the fourth most densely populated sovereign country in the world. So it's very, very considered by many to be just a city state. Everyone knows everyone, which we'll touch on, I think, in later questions. Population 510,000, massive population growth in the last 2 decades, from 390,000 in the year 2000. So that's major demographic changes, with now 22% of the population being described as kind of non-Maltese. We joined the European Union in 2004. And politics is everything in Malta. So politics is in the bars, it's in our piazzas, in our churches, in our schools, in our, you know, in it just politics is the lifeblood of the nation. And it's very, very much almost considered to be something that is integral to family life as well. Public and private domains kind of interact that way. And the two major parties in the country, we have a sort of a bipartisan system, are the Nationalist Party, which is a Christian Conservative Party, and the Labour Party, which is now the ruling party or party in government. The Nationalist Party was ruling, again, I use the word ruling in a, you know, just in government kind of way, for 23 years before the Labour Party in 2013 won a major victory on, ironically, the anti-corruption ticket. There is the existence of third parties, but these are minuscule in comparison, and people are effectively raised blue or red. And this basically dictates every decision that is made politically. And it means that every single decision made by the government is very much felt by the people. There's a lot of proximity to politicians. Rule of law is just something that is coming to the fore since Daphne's assassination, and that's where I'll answer finally your question. So Daphne was murdered in on the 16th of October in 2017. In fact, we mark 6 years since her assassination just next week. Mm-hmm. She was murdered after an explosive device was planted under the seat of her car in Malta. And this was very much the first time that the Maltese public really had any notion of the rule of law brought up, largely because of international outcry, which obviously then emboldened what were muted civil society responses or ability to even act on corrupt practices before. And it was very much a kind of saltanat ad drit, which is what we call it in Malta. What is this? Why does it affect us? Daphne herself represented the very polarized political view in Malta, so the Nationalist versus Labour Party view. So that meant that alongside her excellent work, there were a lot of gossip column type pieces that meant that she was very much hounded by the public, hounded by political classes, and not on everyone's Christmas list. I'll just put it that way. Mm-hmm. She was often accused of classism and hate speech. And one of the things that very much hampered her investigative journalism and also the reputation of her investigative journalism domestically is because of that. And that is why there continues to be this kind of distance from a vast majority of the population to the case. So obviously, that dented her reputation domestically, and it made it very difficult also for her to get recognition for what was going on in Malta. And the major rule of law issues that we had, the major corruption scandals that were just bubbling under the surface, her death and her assassination blew everything wide open. And that meant that it put Malta into a major political crisis, I would argue probably never before seen, especially not since, I guess, independence. We've had major crises in the 80s, especially, and in the late 70s. But this was something where the Maltese public also had to reckon with its own culture, its own political culture, for the first time under the watchful eye of the EU and under the watchful eye of the international community. And I think that was a never before seen situation. An independent public inquiry was launched very late in the day, 2 years later, and it was concluded in July 21. And it concluded essentially that the state should bear ultimate responsibility for the assassination of Daphne Caruana Galizia. Still, we do not have full implementation of the recommendations of the inquiry. They have been mostly brushed aside, and the terms of reference that were put forward followed to a light degree in some respects, but the process being described as deeply intransparent and inaccessible. Alongside the public inquiry, there was also a committee established in relation to reform in media law. Also, this has been described as slow in its reform and untransparent. And despite this 400-page public inquiry report, meaningful legislative steps to address the recommendations put forward have effectively not taken place, have not happened. And this was the case both for the inquiry, as I just mentioned, and the expert committee appointed to oversee these media reforms. So essentially, Malta, for instance, remains one of the countries with the highest number of strategic litigation against public participation, so SLAPs per capita in the European Union. Some steps have been taken to address this in terms of freedom of press, but they are not meaningful enough. And we continue to be faced with major complaints from international bodies, NGOs, about these limitations. And despite them welcoming some progress, you know, better than nothing kind of a better than nothing kind of approach, despite them welcoming some progress, again, these are described as not far reaching enough. And ultimately, even if there is progress, their implementation and the way their implementation is followed has sometimes also been half hearted and half baked, which makes it difficult, obviously, to measure progress and to observe meaningful progress in the area. Ultimately, my argument would be that if you put in legislation and there is no domestic reform education around that legislation, then implementation is always going to be half-hearted and implementation cannot be meaningful. So you cannot really address rule of law, democracy, corruption. If you put in legislation to strengthen rule of law, to strengthen democratic practices, unless there is buy-in domestically, you're not going to really go anywhere. And a lot turns on this. A lot of the answers to my questions will also turn on this. Ultimately, domestic literacy in this regard is limited. at best. It is growing, obviously, because of it appearing repeatedly in our newspapers. On the streets, people talk about this Saltanat Adrit, this rule of law, but ultimately there's no tangible understanding of what it is. This is a culture that has been ingrained over, you know, hundreds of years of occupation and colonization. Its rule of law has very much been intrinsically linked to our occupation and colonization, people going around things, trying to find a way essentially to survive, going around what was, you know, said, well, this is the rule of law. Yes, but the rule of law means that my family is going hungry. My family is staying poor. My family can't get a job. My family, you know, and that is the connotation that we're dealing with here. And even though they wouldn't know necessarily that this was the rule of law, they still see it as having, they still see as having to go around rules, legislative structures that preclude them from getting where they need to be, for better or for worse. So that's kind of trying to explain the context of what is going on. And since Daphne, there has been a marked change in the way domestically we talk about these things, but the current situation in Malta remains incredibly fragile in terms of where we're going and the future of our democracy, for multiple reasons that are related to rule of law, but are also related to a number of issues, including lack of constitutional reform, which allow for these things to kind of descend to the state that they're in.
It's really fascinating to hear how embedded politics is in Maltese society, but perhaps without there being a corresponding rule of law culture. And so more broadly, Laurent Pesch and Kim Lane Scheppler have defined rule of law backsliding as the process through which elected public authorities deliberately implement governmental blueprints, which aim to systematically weaken, annihilate, or capture internal checks on power with the view of dismantling the liberal democratic state and entrenching the long-term rule of the dominant party. You spoke in your last answer about the problems facing Malta with regard to the rule of law, but by the metric proposed by Laurent Pesch and Kim Lane Scheppler, do you think that Malta is undergoing rule of law backsliding?
I think this is going to be a controversial answer. And I really rack my brains to try and find, you know, I'm no Kim Lane Scheppler, and I'm certainly no Laurent Pesch. But my answer is short and simple. No, I don't think there is backsliding in Malta. I think it's been this way, was definitely since time immemorial on my end, but it's been this way before these kind of ideas of you know, rule of law were even developed, at least to this degree, in the EU context. And I mean, when we see corrupt practices taking place now, I think the only difference is that the fight against corruption obviously rages on, as well as justice for Daphne's assassination. And it hasn't necessarily gotten worse. I think what has happened is the tools we have to uncover, including our civil society, journalism, et cetera, freedom of the press, have just gotten much better at exposing what's going on. And Daphne was unique in that sense, because she was the only one essentially standing between the government and corrupt practices. But this was the case also before the Labour government. As I said, I mean, the irony of this is that the Labour government did contest the 2013 election on the anti-corruption ticket. So even though it became now and is synonymous with corruption in the eyes of the international community, the Labour government, headed at the time by Joseph Muscat, after 23 years of nationalist and again in inverted commas ruled, came against corrupt practices of the Nationalist Party, including at the time the oil and gas purchases scandal, which saw senior officials of the Nationalist Party purportedly receive major kickbacks following oil procurements. We will never know the breadth and degree of corruption that was taking place under the Nationalist government, but it was there, it was very much alive and very much kicking. So again, the tools that are there to uncover it are much better, but I don't think there has been backsliding. I think that this is, again, the situation is that, you know, from Panama paper investigations to kickbacks on energy, vote buying, money laundering, tax evasion, fraudulent intent in terms of privatization of its hospitals. These are all corruption scandals that are ongoing right now as we speak, and investigations into them ongoing as we speak. But these things on a high level scale were also taking place before now. And the degree to which, I guess, we'll never know, because it's kind of a discussion we would be having in retrospect and in hindsight rather than, you know, in present tense. So high level and low level scale corruption has been taking place in Malta, and rule of law deficiencies have been observable in the country since it became a state and before that. So I don't think there is backsliding necessarily. I think that, you know, we have just gotten better at recognizing, at calling, naming it what it is, and pointing it out. And we have not gotten terribly good at combating it, but we have gotten at least a space, and we are holding a small but significant space to look at what is going on and to combat it, and to try and face up to the situation in Malta, and at least from civil society's point of view, try to better it.
I think your answer.
Long way to go.
I think your answer points towards a potential nuancing in our understandings of rule of law weaknesses in different contexts, whereas this rule of law backsliding paradigm has really arisen in a post-Soviet Union, post-totalitarian environment in Central and Eastern Europe. Maybe there's something different in the post-colonial context with now Commonwealth countries. So I think that's something really to bear.
Very much so. And I mean, there are allusions and analogies can be made, obviously. And one of the things that I find most interesting about the Maltese case, I'm also studying Hungary at the same time and in parallel, is that I can make those connections, is that history very much plays a major role in the way we have pursued these conversations, in the way we continue to categorize countries, in the way we try to make what I believe to be immeasurable measurable. And it is why I'm such a massive proponent of looking at context, looking at history, trying to understand what role it plays in this situation. Not because it should excuse what's going on, of course not, but it does provide a meaningful explanation, and a meaningful explanation that allows those combating this rule of law crisis, these rule of law perversions to a certain degree, with a space to explain and also tackle their situation domestically in a way that is informed and in a way that is seen as a problem-solving exercise, not a shaming exercise, which I think is part of the problem. Part of the problem why, you know, we have not gotten very far. If anything, we do see more and more backsliding, is because those who are repeatedly saying you're not listening to us are just not being heard. And we're forging ahead with difficult, very black and white definitions of what, you know, a rule of law crisis is and what rule of law means. That doesn't necessarily compute across the EU. It's a very core member state understanding of what rule of law is. It does not account for the discrepancies in institution building approaches, in the state of institution building, in the state of progress, post-colonial state of progress, post-Soviet state of progress. And that means that we often kind of don't separate the wheat from the chaff, and we're not able to see the picture for what it really, really is, and account for all the variables that are in place and in play that make the situation what it really is.
Mm. On that
tangent there, but it really does make a big difference how we see things and how we contextualize something.
Absolutely. And on that theme of comparisons and that broader context of EU membership, you've written recently for the Fasten's blog about a Maltese judgment that could be seen to challenge the primacy of EU law. How does that judgment compare to other challenges to primacy from different member states? Is it closer to the PSPP decision of the German Constitutional Court or the K321 judgment of the Polish Constitutional Tribunal?
I think I'm going to answer the same way I kind of just touched on. I find it difficult to reduce something to a binary, and comparative binary risks missing crucial nuances. And I believe it limits our ability to take a tailored and therefore effective action to both analyze and talk about and ultimately act on a given situation. In the Michael Felsberger case in Malta, which was decided in July 23, so not so long ago, we saw elements of the PSPP judgment. But again, it's just completely different. Germany is not Malta. Germany doesn't have, you know, Malta doesn't have the same safeguards that Germany has. And Malta is not in the same position that Poland is in. Again, it's coming up from a completely different point of view. And for all intents and purposes, this was not, on the face of it, at least a political decision. In my opinion, and what I argue in Verfassen's blog, is it was effectively an issue. It is, and it continues to be an issue, that her constitutional reform allows situations such as, or lack of rather, constitutional reforms, allows situations such as this one to persist. It allows the constitution to be manipulated, and it allows the problems we have with separation of powers, which are again colonial inheritance and something that has just not faced significant reform in the last 60 years. It allows judges to do things like this. And this was a situation where we had never before seen a blow to primacy of EU law in a Maltese context. It's an unspoken kind of code that this would never have happened. But ultimately, lack of constitutional reform meant that it could potentially happen. And everyone was kind of in a wait and see stance. And now that it has actually happened, domestic reactions have been completely muted, because effectively they don't know what to do. This is major. If it goes forward to the next stages and is decided along the same lines, it's going to be huge. And I think everyone is in brace position waiting to see what's going to happen. But it was very clear that the environment, the constitutional environment that has been created, not necessarily, again, because of the immediate rule of law crisis, but because the constitution has been this way for the last 60 years since we gained independence from Britain. Because of this, the judge was able to use the constitution essentially and weaponize the constitution against the EU. And I think that is one of the reasons why I don't want to compare it to the PSP decision or the K321 decision, precisely because I think that it is very interesting in and of itself that we have a case in the EU where colonialism's handprint are all over this rule of law issue. And it makes a case for us to argue that this exists not just in Malta, but also elsewhere in Europe. And could have and is having a continued material impact on the way member states engage with the EU, not just, you know, in legal terms, but also in symbolic terms. I think Malta is an excellent case of that. And this particular case, what I argue in the Verfassen's blog case, is a case where we really need to look at what the longstanding colonial handprints can do and how they can be weaponized against the EU. However, obviously, the context, again, going back to your previous question, the context in Malta is what it is. I can't say it's descending into craziness, because it has been incredibly difficult for a number of decades. The breadth of corruption is quite literally breathtaking. But yes, I don't want to compare it to other decisions. But if I had to, my hands tied, I think it's more the PSP decision than anything else. I don't think this is an anti-EU stance that was taken. I think it was a pro-industry, pro-gaming, pro-protectionist step. And I can't see any reason not to hold that argument, despite obviously there being, for instance, less pro-EU position taken by the Maltese public than ever before. I mean, we saw, I think, a 40% decrease in pro-EU sentiment over the last year alone in Malta. I don't think this was part and parcel with that, though. Again, I can't tell for certain.
It's really interesting to hear how this gap or opportunity for contestation can come from one could say, a discrepancy between constitutional text and legal and political reality. So I think that's a really intriguing thing to consider for the future and potential judgments like this as well. And on that topic of court judgments and EU law, the so-called principle of non-regression from the Copenhagen criteria following accession to the EU for member states was actually proposed by the Court of Justice in a case concerning Malta, the Republika judgment. What is the current situation concerning the appointment of judges in Malta? And could the argument be made that courts could be regarded as captured in the same way as in Poland and Hungary? Or do you believe, again, that this isn't reflective of reality?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer. You definitely put me through my paces, Oliver. I have not had my brain functioning for quite a while these last months. And now I've been reading these questions and really, really trying to think about the importance of nuance here. Progress has, and as the Republika judgment itself stated and made clear, progress has been made in Malta since accession to the EU. And it was one of the reasons why, in this case, regression couldn't necessarily be observed, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. So the Judicial Appointments Committee in Malta, which was set up in 2016 in accordance with Article 96A of the Constitution, is put in place essentially to make these judicial appointments. And the ire and the issue turns on the role of the president in electing these judges. Or magistrates exclusively from the names of the three candidates that are transmitted by the committee. So the influence of the executive remains strong. And as what I surmised from the case, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, executive power to appoint judges is, you know, unilaterally a bad or incorrect thing. We see many examples of this across the continent and beyond. We don't need to go very far to understand politicization of judicial appointments. But progress, again, on the ground has been slow and, again, not far-reaching enough. For instance, in terms of involvement of the judiciary in the procurement for appointment of the Chief Justice, these are recommendations that were put forward by the Venice Commission and also then communicated in the Rule of Law Report 2022. The addressing the need for involvement of the judiciary in this procedure is essentially non-existent. So even though there have been changes made, these are not far-reaching enough. And again, we come back to the issue of the role of the executive, the inflated role of the executive in Malta. Why the role of the executive continues to be so enormous by comparison, why separation of powers is so problematic, and one of the reason is lack of constitutional reform. So again, I come to that argument, and constitutional reform requires us as a nation also understanding what our position as an EU, as a modern EU member state, is on issues like the rule of law, democracy. What do we want our member state to look like? And at the moment, we're just basically navigating with a blueprint that was handed to us. And that makes it very difficult to amend and adjust according to what we want our nation and our nation state to be designed, and how we want our nation state to be designed and what we want it to look like. So I don't consider the courts captured, not in the same sense, again, as the Polish case, as we see in the Polish case. But even then, that has its nuances, its significant nuances. But in the Maltese case, of course, there are political links, and these are completely blatant and in your face in many respects. But there is also the argument to be made that as long as the situation, the legal system is designed the way it is, and our constitution, a constitutional framework designed the way it is, then it will allow for these things to happen. And obviously it is in the political classes, both sides' best interest to maintain this kind of degree of power and this kind of political leverage by design. Will continue to exist precisely because, and has continued to exist precisely because, having that kind of political power is an invaluable tool to a political party. And that is the sad fact. So we all know what, at least for the Maltese context, the Repubblica case elicited, but it was not necessarily surprising. As long as we stay the way we are and as long as we don't engage in meaningful reform, then this will continue to be the case. And our judicial appointments, a constitutional mess and weak.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to some of the other mechanisms that are in the EU's increasing rule of law enforcement toolbox, we've seen that the rule of law conditionality regulation has recently been activated against Hungary. Now, despite the origins of this mechanism as a pure rule of law instrument, it is now tied strictly to the protection of the EU budget and may be regarded as an anti-corruption instrument. We've been discussing some of the issues around corruption in Malta. So do you think there's any prospect at all that the regulation could be used against Malta in the future?
I doubt it. I don't think so. And in the last EU budget negotiations, sort of around 2020, we have to, again, now knowing a little bit of the context of what was going on in Malta at the same time. So we had the DCG public inquiry, we had stepping down of our prime minister, we had multiple corruption scandals unfolding at the same time, the Golden Passport scheme, which, you know, really gripped public attention, EU public's attention. Negotiations took place over 2 years before coming to the final conclusion, which was that Malta was actually given more in terms of an allocated sum. In fact, I believe it was, at least the prime minister argued that it was double what was allocated to Malta in the past package, which was negotiated in 2013. So he made on the base, and he made the argument that this was done and these allocations were made on the basis of 6 months worth of progress in terms of the rule of law and the rule of law reforms achieved by his government, which the EU, again, the Prime Minister Robert Abela argued was considered enough to achieve the final outcome of these budget negotiations. So in terms of the rule of law conditionality, I think that speaks volumes about whether or not this is going to be leveled in Malta's regard. I don't think so. And the interesting thing about it is that during the budget negotiations in 2020, Malta actually argued that it was on the forefront of putting in this conditionality mechanism. And it was one of the main member states, one of the key member states arguing for its introduction. So, no, I don't think so. I think that there will continue to be the commission following Malta very intently. But I also think Malta sometimes gets away with things because it's so small and it's not, how can I say, a sexy enough case to bring forward. I mean, and I, again, because I don't like false equivalencies, I won't compare it to Hungary, I won't compare it to Poland, I won't compare Poland to Hungary because they are two separate cases. The situation has to be judged based on face value and based on what it is. And I think Malta would qualify for these kind of restrictions, but I don't think it will. And I mean, what happened in the last negotiations, I think speaks volumes for what would be to come if they did. Ultimately, they were given a space to make changes. They made some changes. These were not far-reaching enough, but they were enough to go forward. And during that time, there were very heavy criticisms of Hungary and Poland as well. So focus remained there. And that is interesting in and of itself. Why? Why is that the case? Who knows?
For our final question, I thought we'd return to some of that background context that you provided so informatively at the start of our interview. And in your Verfassen's blog piece, you argue that the lack of full separation of powers in Malta may be caused by the difficulties of having such a small population. Do you think that independence of institutions and the avoidance of personal interference is made difficult by the fact that the ruling classes are so small in number? And if so, can safeguards be implemented to mitigate this effect?
Answer to the first question is that yes, of course, conflict of interest, personal interference is obviously made difficult by the fact that we are 500,000 people. We went to the same schools. We grew up together. We're often related to each other. If not related, we're related to the relation of someone else. And I mean, again, this sounds trite and silly to say, but this is Malta. This is how Malta has always and will always look. It is a small country with a very small population. That does not mean, of course, that things can't be done to mitigate the situation on the ground. Obviously, conflict of interest does not necessarily mean corruption. It's not equivalent. Mm-hmm. Conflict of interest is not corruption, right? It is a situation that can very easily, but not necessarily, lead to corruption. And in the Maltese context, it often does, but it also, there are instances where obviously it does not, and instances where people can separate one from the other. So yes, it's extremely difficult to completely remove conflict of interest in Malta, but that should not be an excuse to avoid the bolstering of good governance practices, transparency, ethics codes, accountability mechanisms, and just generally reforms aimed at limiting to the best of one's or the institution's ability, limiting personal interference and putting in place an overall robust anti-corruption reform that is meaningful and far-reaching, and that gives a grassroots change to the way we operate in our government and the way we interact with our institutions, both bottom up and top down. None of this has been done. I mean, only very little initiative has been taken again. And these small steps, and they have been described as small steps by presiding bodies like the Venice Commission, are also sometimes being ridiculed by the population, because I think the population the people are desperate to understand which direction they should be going in order to comply and in order to understand how this rule of law concept, in inverted commas, applies to their daily life. And without sea change from a grassroots level as to, you know, how we interact with our institutions, that's not going to happen. So again, I come back to something I said earlier in the recording and in the podcast. Legislation is something. It's nice to have good, robust legislation that puts into place rule of law safeguards, that safeguards our democracy, that safeguards, that puts in anti-corruption mechanisms. But ultimately, this is what is required, is a wholesale review and view of how the way we interact with our institutions needs to change. Because ultimately, you know, corruption is happening, and nepotism and clientelism and so forth. And it's happening because people are engaging in it. And it's so widespread because people choose that way forward. So we also need to understand that the people have a big hand in what is going on. And that also needs to be addressed. So any legislation has to come with education, and any legislation has to come with a comprehensive understanding of how this intrinsically impacts the way our life works and how the way our society works and the health of our society and the health of our democracy overall. So yes, but again, this is why context is important and needs to be at the forefront of considerations in the Malta case and in the Malta example, because proximity is ever present and it's in every aspect of our lives in the country.
Well, thank you so much for this interview, Jenny. I'm sure our listeners will feel far more informed on the rule of law situation in Malta.
After I hope so, at least a little bit more informed. That's all I hope for.
And I'd encourage our listeners to follow us on X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram, and also to subscribe to the podcast for further such conversations in the future. Thank you so much again, Jenny.
Thanks a lot, Oliver.